Welcome to Booked, where two guys tell you about the books they're reading. I'm Rob Olson.
And I'm Livia Snedden. Happy New Year, Rob.
Hey, Happy New Year.
It's our first episode of 2018.
The first of many.
The first of some episodes.
The first of at least a handful. I don't know.
The first book review of at least, God, who knows, maybe a dozen this year. Hey, listen, last year we started off 2017 by talking about a book that was put together from two stories.
Yeah. Serious Moonlight,
right? With a charitable feel around it. All money was being donated to charity that was taken in on that book. And now it's 2017, and we are going to review a book that's a compilation of two stories by different authors that also has a charitable aspect. I didn't want to say an aspect. Like, this is a full-blown charitable thing here. So we'll talk about that more in a little bit, but I thought that was kind of interesting that we started off both years with some generosity, I guess.
Yeah, what are the odds? And it fell off real fast after that. Like, we were like, hit our quota.
Well, yeah, that's why we got out of the year early, right?
Yeah.
So we got to start doing them at the end of the year so I can take my goddamn tax deduction. That's what I need from these charitable things. My tax break.
Right to the taxes.
Another Way to Fall, two short novels by Brian Evanson and Paul Tremblay. We'll talk a little bit about Free Concord Press, I think, later. So I think we're going to jump right into the book. Rob, tell them a little bit about these two fine authors.
So I'm going to point out before I read these bios that there's something missing from each of them. And I'm going to see if that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to see if you can guess what it is. The first author, Brian Evanson, is the author of a dozen books of fiction. I can never say fiction. I don't know what it is. I'm in the wrong business. Most recently, the story collection, A Collapse of Horses, and the novella, The Warren. Paul Tremblay is the author of seven novels, including Disappearance at Devil's Rock, A Head Full of Ghosts, The Little Sleep, and the forthcoming, The Cabin at the End of the World. What's missing? What would you put in there if you were the author?
Both have been guests of the book podcast.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, we reviewed almost everything that was listed there.
Yeah, I mean, one day they'll get it. They'll figure it out. They'll add that in and understand what a draw that is. And really, I mean, who are they hurting by not putting in there just themselves, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So here's a little bit about the book. Drop into the fascinating hallucinatory world of Another Way to Fall, the dark brainchild of Brian Evanson and Paul Tremblay. Evanson's baby leg... That's right, guys. I said baby leg. And Tremblay's The Harlequin and the Train appeared in limited editions that are largely unavailable. Now, Another Way to Fall brings these fantastic award-winning writers together and puts these haunting novels in the eager hands of new and generous readers. In Baby Leg, a mysterious man awakes one morning in an isolated cabin with no memory of how he's gotten there or why he's missing a hand. The book has been described as the kind of thing that might have happened if David Goodis and Jim Thompson tried to write a mad scientist story in the middle of a bender. Powerful and profoundly eerie, Tremblay's The Harlequin and the Train spins a surreal tale of a young train engineer, a commuter train accident, and its disturbing aftermath. As novelist Laird Barron put it, Tremblay pierces the veil of prosaic suburban life to reveal its dark heart.
And there's probably not a lot we're going to be able to say about either of these stories.
Let's give this book some stars. So the first story is Baby Leg. It is surreal is probably not a strong enough word for what the story is. Would you agree there's got to be a stronger word for this? As it indicated in the synopsis, the man wakes up. He's missing a hand. He has no memory, but it seems to be that everybody he runs into kind of has an idea who he is. And as he slowly goes further and further into the couple of days surrounding this awakening, he finds out that things aren't exactly what they seem.
Yeah. So I think... We don't do this very often, but I'm just going to read aloud like the first two to three sentences of Baby Leg, to give you an idea of what like you're starting with this story, because it really grabbed me right away. And I think, Livius, you may have had a similar reaction that you mentioned to me. I could be wrong about that. Here we go. Night after night, Kraus dreamt of a woman with a normal leg and a baby leg. In the dream, she clomped about on her adult-sized knee and the baby leg, wielding an axe, lurching. Jesus Christ, man.
This character who the protagonist is kind of named Baby Leg appears repeatedly in dreams that he has. And I got to tell you, when was the last time you heard me say, I was really okay with all the dream sequences in this story?
I don't think that's ever happened.
Yeah, I mean, it really, like, the dreams were so weird and done in very, I would say very standard, like your subconscious is trying to tell you things kind of way, because that's how dreams are typically written into stories and even when they appear in movies and stuff. But in this story, because of how bizarre the story is, it didn't bother me at all. Like, which is saying, I might as well say I loved it, right? Because all they dream sequences mm-hmm. bother me all the time. So, but I think it played super well in this particular story.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing about the story in general. It starts out with there's obviously some information missing from the perspective of the protagonist. Like, he wakes up and doesn't remember things and isn't 100% sure what's going on. And it's the type of story that doesn't get better as time goes on. It just gets more kind of confusing. And so it's definitely like this like heavily skewed reality where we, along with the protagonist, are kind of just struggling to figure out what's real, what's not real, who has the, you know, who's the good guys, who's the bad guys, who's the protagonist. And because of that, it's hard to, yeah, it's hard to talk plot, but it's cool in that it's got a very, I'm trying to think of what it feels like. I know I've read stories similar and I can't think off the top of my head. If I had to go with a more modern example, it would be like the movie Memento, because he's got that loss of short-term mm-hmm. memory and he has sure. to kind of like try and remind himself. It's got that kind of feel to it because he's trying to just discover like the basics of reality, but it's got a very unique style to it.
I feel like it reminds me of a lot of Brian Evanson stuff, which, you know, I'm not trying to be yeah. funny. It's the thing that I love about most of his work. So, you know, longer time listeners or whatever will know, I didn't love The Warren. I wanted to, because I've absolutely loved everything else I've read by him. The Warren didn't really do it for me in that way. And I realize this is a much older story, so I'm getting it now in the order that I could read them. This, to me, is what I look forward to when I'm reading a Brian Evanson story or book. So obviously this was written, you know, way back when. I don't know specifically it was written around the time Last Days was written. I felt that way about the novel Last Days. Like, it had that same kind of surreal feel to it. And this is the Brian Evanson I want to read.
Yeah, it's top shelf Brian Evanson. And does he have a thing with limbs? Did we talk about
it seems that way.
Something about, yeah, like people missing... Mm-hmm. missing limbs. Yeah. So
I actually thought, as I started this, I thought it might tie into, to Last Days, which was the first thing I read from him, which was, that was a novel, short novel, maybe novella length, but yeah, that had a lot to do with missing limbs. And as I read like three or four pages, I was like, I wonder if this has a, and it doesn't.
Right.
You know, I came to realize on my own that it doesn't, but it felt that way. I thought, oh, this could possibly be some kind of weird tie-in story to that.
Yeah.
You know, we meet some other people, and again, we're not going to go too much into plot. We're probably not even going to do spoiler talk on these two. But like I said, we meet other characters, and they all seem to know exactly who he is, and it's up to him to discover what's going on. I do. So we read this book, as far as I know, is only available in paper copies, which is how we read it. So I don't have the same kind of note taking ability that I would if I was reading this on my Kindle. There's a great line in there, though, that a character tells him at one point, and the character says something like, this is what he questions the reality of something. And the character says something along the lines of this is what's real right now.
Yeah. Yes, it was Baby Leg. Like, yep. The only thing that's real is now, or something like yep. that.
And I thought that was great. I recently heard something. I was watching the news or something, but someone had said something along those lines. Like, if you believe it enough, it's real to you.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of along the same lines, and I thought it fit very well in this particular story.
Yeah, I heard on a podcast about the X-Files recently that there was a doctor saying something like that.
Maybe that's where I heard it. I just cited our other podcast, The View, as a news source, is what just happened there. Jesus.
Oh, wow. But yeah, and so, yeah, I think Baby Leg, we really can't say much more. It strikes me as kind of like if I had to put into perspective the way I felt when I was reading it, like, you know, there's those video games where it's got like I think the effect is called like the fog of war, where like you can only see so far in any direction and everything else is dark.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about? So I feel like that's what this story was written like, is like you only have an understanding of like what's immediately around, like before or in the present. And so there's so much unknown that like literally anything can happen. So it really keeps you very invested in like any bit of information that comes through, trying to figure out what the hell's going on. So yeah, it was definitely a compelling story. It was like 60 pages or so. So not very long at all, but, it was a great, great story.
This goes back a little bit into what we talked about in the year in review. And we were kind of, criticizing short stories. I don't know if that's what we were doing when we were exploring the short stories in their current place in literature as we see it. It's a perfect example of something that's 60, 70 pages that was just terrific.
Nailed it.
Just terrific. Now, I don't know, again, to kind of go back to that, I loved it. So, spoiler alert, totally love this story. You know, how well would it do if you packaged it by itself? I don't know. Probably not as well as I would imagine the demand will be for both of these stories together.
That's an interesting, and I'll take us on a little sidetrack. Friend of the podcast, Brandon Teets, tweeted at us recently. He was listening to our review of Scott Free by Rob Hart, and I don't know if you saw this tweet, But he was asking about, you know, how we feel about novellas and stuff being standalone and all. And so it got me to thinking. And one of the things that I came to was I like standalone novellas. Sometimes, like if Stephen Graham Jones comes out with a novella, I'm going to read it because I'm a big fan of his work. I'm less likely to read something from someone I don't know if it's just them. But if there's more than one, like, novella, short novel, whatever you want to call it, grouped together, I prefer it to be of multiple authors. Like, I don't want to read four novellas by the same author, if that makes sense.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That is interesting. No, I did see that. And I think when I got my new phone back in October, I think I installed my Twitter client but never signed into it. I don't have a booming relationship with Twitter. So I did not see that. I don't know. I'm not sure where I'm at on that. I might have to give that some thought. I do like the novellas, but again, I think it's sort of what you said. I am far more likely to read a novella by somebody whose stuff I like.
Yeah.
Even if it is a standalone and there's nothing else attached to it. I'd read another Brian Evanson novella in a heartbeat. I've loved, like I said, basically almost everything that I've read from him, and that's sufficient. We reviewed quite a bit of his stuff, and I read some stuff on my own. So, let's see how we feel about Paul Tremblay and his novella. You want to get that started?
Yeah. So the story that Paul contributed to this book, Another Way to Fall, is called The Harlequin and the Train, and you heard a little bit about the main characters in the synopsis that Livius read, a train engineer, there's an accident and all that kind of stuff. And so the story kicks off with, our protagonist is Rudy in this story. And he's, a train engineer. And he, after some like work kind of banter, goes out to his day where he's on the train, and there's something like there was a conversation before he got on the train about the train hitting people and how frequently it happens. And then he's on the train, and then lo and behold, there's something in the tracks that looks like a person. And there's this kind of back and forth about like, does he hit the emergency brake thing or not? And So even though he eventually does, still hits the person on the tracks. And then weird things start to happen immediately after the impact as the train stops.
Right. The way we're introduced to this is kind of from three different points of view of three different, actors in this story. Rudy definitely being the one that we follow all the way through. Mm-hmm. But there's a subculture or a cult or something that plays very heavily into this. I think Paul did a great job of making me want to know more about those people, which is something that I always love in a story where you create. So Baby Leg, I'm not ready to compare the stories or anything, but Baby Leg was very localized, right? Like you got the feeling there was maybe a dozen total people involved in this really kind of small story that was super intense.
Right.
The Harlequin and the Train lends itself to a much bigger story that we're only seeing a particular part of, like Rudy coming across something that's completely foreign to him. He's your regular kind of everyday guy who suffered some trials in his life. But he kind of falls into this situation where he has to have some involvement with this mysterious group of people. He's got a sister who had a stroke, several years ago, that plays a big part in his life. So it's a lot of learning about his backstory and how that kind of maybe ties into what's happening to him today.
Yeah. The people involved in the culty kind of whatever you want to call it, the unnamed group of people that Livia's mentioned earlier. There's a girl named Jenny who, we see just very small amount of her life. I think she was she works in real estate and, she's one of the people who knew ahead of time that this train thing was going to happen, and was one of the people acting weird. There's also a guy who's only ever referred to as the businessman who was on the train in preparation for this incident to happen and participating in what happened afterwards. And they kind of play really, really tiny threads throughout. They're basically just there to represent, like, these are some of the people that do the weird stuff. I guess we should acknowledge really quickly that the reason it's called the Harlequin and the Train is that after the impact, it's discovered that it wasn't a person on the train tracks, but it was actually like, and this is really weird, like a dummy dressed up like a Harlequin, which is like an old fucking clown, right?
Yes, essentially, yeah.
Yeah. Like stuffed with like meat, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably how I would describe it too. With meat, I guess that's accurate.
It's because like, and it's never like super gone into. It's more what people do afterwards than like what the composition of this Harlequin doll dummy thing was. So you don't really know exactly what's going on or how it got there. It's just like it's on the tracks, obviously, so that the train will hit it, so that these freaking weirdos can react.
That's all we can really say about the story. Rudy is a good character because he starts out super normal, like I'm gonna go to work and do my thing, and like I said, you kind of find out more of his backstory and you find he's carrying a lot of weight. And he has a chance to interact with what's going on in this story and the decisions he makes and stuff. There's a little bit of maybe a supernatural thing happening there. Not really sure. Definitely a worthwhile story. And again, like I said, a story that's much bigger than the pages that it fills.
Yeah. I would say that like Rudy's character, at the beginning of the story is a very, like Livia said, normal life, but kind of a sad, boring life, which is just completely thrown into chaos by, the aftermath of this train accident and then other things that happen in the story. But like it becomes very strange. And, the thing that I liked most about Rudy's story is the flashbacks. And so I guess I'm going to pause to acknowledge, and I don't know if you noticed this, Livius, how, there was chapters in the story, Harlequin and the Train, and they were numbered out of order. And it was cool because, like, basically the story is written non-linear. It jumps forward, jumps back, all that kind of stuff. But instead of having consistent chapter numbers, like one through whatever, he put the chapter number that corresponded to when in Rudy's life it happened, which I thought was really neat. And it threw me off at first, but then I was like, oh, we're going back in time. I could tell by the chapter number.
I completely did not catch that. I'm thumbing through the book now.
And, so the first chapter is chapter six. Yeah.
I somehow missed that completely.
Yeah. First chapter is chapter six, then seven, then it jumps to, eight, nine, mm-hmm. 10. Then it goes back to one. And one is like the earliest thing we read about him, and it's his childhood. And so, like, that was, for me, that was my little cue of knowing where we were going in the story. But I like the flashbacks a lot because you get to, like, there was a tragedy that happened, like Livia said, to Karen, his sister. And going back to before that tragedy and seeing how they interacted, the story is really about, like, all these awful things that have happened in Rudy's life and what he chooses to do about it. And so, those flashbacks really kind of explain why he is the guy he is and what he's doing now. But the coin flipping thing, that's what you were kind of not referring to, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the coin flipping thing? I can just explain that it was a thing, or we can talk about.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. We can do whatever we want. It's our podcast. I don't want to spoil anything, but yeah, there is a little bit of a weird element there.
So in the flashback, in one of the earliest moments of Rudy's life that we get to see, his sister, as a class project, is doing something about probability or something like that. And so she enlists Rudy to flip a coin and record. So he has to, like, choose what it's going to be beforehand and then flip a coin. And then so he records what his choice was and his results. And then he basically does an average of how often he was right. And the idea is it's going to be pretty close to 50-50. That's what the results should come out to. And so all I'll say beyond that is that I, at least, was led to believe that anomalies in the coin flipping had something to do with the way the story turned out.
Yeah, I think I feel like maybe the exact opposite of what you said, in that things that happen in the stories affect the coin flipping.
Oh, and well, yeah, it could be that way too.
So,
yeah.
So a little bit, yes, we're on the same page, just in different directions, I guess, on that. But I thought that was kind of fascinating.
Yeah, because it's such a mundane thing. And yeah, it wasn't overplayed. It was just, it came up a couple times. You know, he had a special quarter that his sister gave him specifically for that challenge. And, but it came up in a way where I was like, man, what's up with these coin flips? It was a cool element to the story.
I think that, and Paul is a mathematician and he may listen to this. So I don't want to speak out of turn. Yeah, I think that's right. I think if you're guessing coin flips, you should be pretty close to 50%. Now, you can have anomalies and things. I know this from roulette, of all things.
That's right. You're a big gambler. I forgot about that.
I know a lot about gambling. I'm not currently a big gambler. I haven't been a big gambler for a long time. And I never really liked roulette, to be honest. But I have read things about, like, patterns in roulette and stuff. And it's not impossible or even really unlikely to get a streak of blacks versus reds or vice versa, you know, where it goes and it's, you know, 2-1, 2-1, 2-1, 1-1, 2-8. But the only way to come out on top of that is obviously to be there during that particular ride and only to bet one side. So when you're guessing and you're going to assume you're changing your guess, right, as you're flipping, then yeah, it should be pretty close to 50-50. But over a period of time, a short period of time, if you just bet tails all the time, there is a good chance that you would come out either with a number that's higher or lower, depending on, you know, if it just comes up heads 5 or 6 times in a row versus tails. So,
yeah. Yeah. And I forgot Paul teaches math and everything like that. So, but yeah, that was cool. It was a cool part of it.
Yeah. It's another good story. I think that, and we talked a lot more about this story because I think that, the type of story it is lends for us to talk more without spoiling a whole lot.
Yeah.
Than we could with Baby Leg. But I think they were both equally weird. Like, so that's how these two stories fit together well, is that they live in, they could live in the same world of weird fiction. Would you agree with that? Or do you think they're, for sure.
And they both had an element of like, even though, you know, you and I would say professionally read in a way, like we're a little bit more, we analyze, well, maybe not, you didn't notice the fucking chapter numbers. but we kind of analyze as we read instead of just kind of like being along for the ride. Again, I know that I probably do that more than you do. There was a consistent element in both of the stories of just like me not really 100% knowing like what the result or outcome was, or, you know, there's like an unsureness to it, like, which is based in that weirdness.
Right. And when done right, I think that that's okay. Like, your story, if it's weird enough that it's left open to some interpretation.
Yeah.
Which I really think both of these were, totally. One more than the other. I'm not going to spoil which one. I think it's okay if it's done that way. I think if you're trying to tell a straight story and it's left open to interpretation, that's where the problem comes in. You know what I mean?
So yeah. Or if you're not a good writer and you're just making it vague because you can't figure out what the hell to do with it, like that type of thing.
Yeah, ambiguity is okay if it's planned ambiguity.
If you got the chops. Yeah, if you got the chops to make it happen.
Before we do a more traditional wrap-up and rating, there's probably a few things that are noteworthy to discuss regarding, I don't know, the evolution, the lifespan, something of these stories, I guess.
Yeah, there's some notes from the author at the back of the book that were interesting to read as well, where, and I won't read exactly what it says out, but I'll just kind of sum it up. The Baby Leg story by Brian Evanson was originally in, serially published in a magazine called Ellipsis. So just in magazine, you know, in issues of a magazine. And then in 2009, a limited edition of 400 copies were printed of the story. And then it was published in French, in a French translation. But like, so it was neat to hear that like this story's been around for, well, it's 2018 now, so 12 years at least in print, but only like, it came out here for a little bit and then it was gone. And then it came out here for 400 copies and then that was it. So, and then again, with this, I believe that Concord Free Press does a limited production of like 3,000 copies and they're numbered. So, again, this story is not relegated to, but like is becoming alive in a limited capacity, which I thought was cool.
Agreed. I mean, this is like I said, a great thing if you're a fan and didn't get a chance to pick up one of 400 limited copies.
Or don't speak French.
Voulez-vous. I don't know what that means. Paul's story, The Harlequin and the Train, was originally appeared in a shorter version in an anthology, which he then was encouraged to develop into more of a screenplay that apparently was not made into a movie. But then he adapted the screenplay back to a longer story. So this is its third iteration, apparently. So again, something that was available only in an anthology. And this is, I believe, the first time, correct me if I'm wrong from memory, that it's available in kind of its full current status.
Well, it says, and I don't know if this is the same thing, but published a limited run of this short novel in early 2009.
Oh, that's right. Yep, you're right.
So
you're correct. So again, limited run. Still limited run. Limited run.
Yeah.
But a big limited run. I don't remember how many it was. Was it 3,000, 2,000?
Of this book?
Yeah.
I think it was 3,000. And I guess mine's number 710. I don't know if you looked at your number.
I did. It's also in the 700s.
Oh, so special.
Specifically 709. So
taking off the
pile one after the other.
That's great. So that's cool. There's a little bit of like a storied past for these things. And it doesn't feel like, oh, they just dusted off something. It felt like, hey, we think that these will work well together, kind of themed or whatever. But I got a lot of respect for both of these authors. So I could just be like, you know, giving them way more credit than is due.
Maybe. I don't know how to respond to that.
There's really nothing to say about that. I'm just like, maybe I'm like romanticizing this in my mind, and it just happened to be the two stories that they had available.
I I'm going to go ahead and start my wrap up. Yeah. I already love this because of the structure, which we're going to talk about a little bit after the wrap up. So I was predetermined to really like these stories, or what's the word I'm looking for? Not predetermined. I don't know. I planned on really liking these stories because I thought the whole concept was really cool. And I mean, I've read enough Brian Evanson and enough Paul Tremblay to know that I really can't go very wrong with these guys. And turns out they were both right up my alley. Like, this is when someone says weird fiction, this is like what I think of as great weird fiction, where it's really kind of grounded in reality, but then has like these really weird twists to it. And maybe you're not sure what's going on. Maybe you never find out what's going on. I don't think that's what the current definition of weird fiction really is in general. But this is what I think great weird fiction is. Both stories, although very different, Baby Leg, really kind of, I thought, small scale, very localized to one area and to a group of people. Harlequin and the Train, much bigger story. Both of them had the same element of strange goings on that are just outside of your reach of understanding, like what the motivations of people are and what's really happening. Super fun to read. I really enjoyed both of them, and I'm going to give the whole book overall 5 stars.
Believe the word you were looking for is predisposed.
It was totally predisposed.
Yeah. This book came on our radar when Paul basically posted on his Facebook account like pictures of the advanced copies that he received, I believe is how I first saw it. And then I frantically messaged Livius about it. I'm not sure whether he already knew about it or not, but I was like, buddy, this has to happen. And if you think about this, we haven't really directly addressed it, but this book kind of breaks one of our cardinal rules of reviewing a book, which is that the book has to be like readily available for everyone. This isn't. So I was like, please, I hope Livius just lets us review this because it might be difficult for people to get it. So what I will say up front is, like, if you are interested in this based on our review, or you're just a big fan of Brian Evanson or Paul Tremblay, or you just like giving to charities, which we'll talk in a minute, go as quickly as you can to actually try and get a copy of this from the press. That being said, my interest was piqued. I was very excited about this book from the very get-go. And the stuff that I've read from Evanson and from Tremblay in the past, I've liked everything. I liked The Warren much more than Livius did. And so I knew I was in for something good. And for some reason, the fact that it's shorter fiction from both of them just made me a little bit more confident that it was going to be quality stuff. And it ended up being quality stuff. Baby Leg was creepy, but it had like an old school kind of noir feel for me for some reason, even though it was definitely more in the realm of like sci-fi. But even in the synopsis, David Goodis and Jim Thompson tried to write a mad scientist story in the middle of a bender. So it's kind of even... It's mentioned in the synopsis, so I feel good saying it kind of had a noir feel to it. And Baby Leg was just creepy. It had some... It was just cool. I liked it a lot. Harlequin and the Train, a little bit more confusing. Not as straightforward for me. But like Livius was saying, we only saw a little bit of this like little shadowy cabal of people doing weird stuff. That made me so interested to find out what the hell is going on in this weird little world. But it was built on the solid foundation of the tragedy of a life of a guy who had lost things in his life and had bad things happen to him and what he would do in this weird situation. So just really well composed and a great story. So loved them both. And I think I'm gonna go with Livius. It's gonna be 5 stars.
Concord Free Press. That's where you can submit to get a book. I'm not really sure what you say. Like, that's where you could request a
copy. Request.
I'm going to read this directly from their webpage. We publish free books that inspire generosity. All we ask is that you donate any amount to a charity or someone in need and tell us about it. Then pass your book along so others can give. Our books have inspired 1.5 million plus in generosity. So everything about these books is almost everything about these books is done for free. So the authors submit stories for free, editing, layouts, cover, all of that is contributed through the generosity of people who know how to do those things. And the costs that they have are the printing of books, which is no small cost, to be honest, at 2,000 copies. You know, this is a quality book that I have in my hand here. Yeah. You know, so that's the cost, and then shipping them out. So they donate their time, and somehow through the Concord ePress, I believe maybe is where they get. They also accept donations for the actual printing of books and stuff. But I think through sales of their ebook channel might be where they get the money to do the printing.
And merch and stuff. They have merch.
Yes. Yes, they do. The cool thing about, like Rob said, they're numbered. So the process is this. Once you are done with your book, there are 10 lines where you can sign your name, preferably just on one of them, I think. And then you you pass it on to somebody else who also has the ability then to read it, make a donation, and pass it on to someone else. And there is a sort of tracking on the website. When you make your donation, you upload your name, where you're from, which book, the number of the book, which is kind of interesting. I didn't dig enough to see if you can actually see like where your book ends up, because that would be kind of cool too. And I think it's just fantastic. I appreciate the work is put in for free by them, and that they still figure out a way to get some scratch together to print these books. But I'm fascinated by the concept, and I think what they're doing is a great thing. Best I can tell, it looks like they have 7 books, if I counted correctly, scrolling down my webpage, including one by Scott Phillips. I don't know how that slipped past us.
Yeah, so let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, I want to say that what they did was to kind of crack the code of charity when it comes to books. And what I mean by that is, we talked about at the beginning of the episode, there was a charitable book where, I know, like the proceeds from the book went to a charity. But that's a one and done. Right. So like if I had bought a print copy of a book, money went to charity. And then if I gave that book to someone or I donated it, so like whoever got the book next, there was no onus for them to do anything. It was just a book that they could read. But with this whole passing it along thing, like the person who receives the book is encouraged to also donate. And so it carries on to, you know, future readers, the whole like, let's donate more. So, you know, this, you know, we hand this book over to someone, they are going to donate, they're going to hand it along, that next person's going to donate, which I thought was really cool. So way to be innovative, first of all. But then second of all, at the end of the book, there's a newspaper where it's got the list of all the different people. You know what I'm talking about?
Obituary.
It's not an obituary. Anyway, it's got a list of all the different people who are associated with Concord Free Press and their positions. There's a word for it, and I just can't remember. But looking at some of the names, they got some heavy hitters involved. So in the advisory board, Megan Abbott is a name that I'm familiar with. You got Gregory Maguire. You know who Gregory Maguire is?
Wicked.
Yeah, wrote Wicked and all those. Joyce Carol frickin' Oates.
I think it's just Joyce Carol Oates.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know if memory serves correctly, but
Scott Phillips on there, Paul Tremblay's in there, and Brian is too, right? Brian Evanson's somewhere in here. I thought I saw his name. Anyway, so I feel like, and then there's probably the other names are probably all big names that I just haven't heard. So I feel like they have like a good support system for like Livia said, drawing in that talent who are going to do all that work. Donate all that work to make this happen. But I was looking at that list on the advisory board and I was like, damn, those are some names. But I would imagine that that might be how Scott Phillips got involved. Sure. And it's available. His is available as an ebook now. So.
Right. Yeah. So I strongly urge people to read this book, A, because it's great. Second, because there's a charitable aspect. There's some good deed. And the fact that that good deed goes to wherever you would like for it to go. So, you know, on the website is a list of where people have donated by book, if I'm correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. By title, yeah.
So, Yeah, so you can actually see where readers gave to get an idea in case you don't already have things. But I've seen, you know, everything from animal rescues to humane societies to, you know, Goodwill, the ACLU. So, I mean, really, whatever it is that the cause that you feel is closest, nearest and dearest to your heart. Someone to the Barack Obama Foundation is on here for anybody who's participating in that. Lots of well-known and then some less well-known. There's like some food banks and stuff that are local. So another great way to contribute locally if you're not interested in contributing on a national level to an organization.
I actually see a familiar name on the list of donations from the Another Way to Fall list. I don't know if you at the very bottom of that list.
There's a really long list here.
Well, just for Another Way to Fall, there's like...
Okay, now I've got to see who this... Oh, here we go. It's just right at the top. I apparently scrolled. Oh, look at that. I know that name.
Yeah. Well, good for him.
I guess that just leaves a couple of things for us to do, right? We have to figure out a way to give away our copies to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have to donate some stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, we're each doing $25. And mine is going to go to, a charity that I haven't thought about in a long time, but as I was thinking of like where I wanted to donate money, I wanted it, because it's a book, I wanted it to be more specific to reading. So back when I was just a youngster, the RIF program, Reading is Fundamental, there's an organization, if you're not familiar with it, their job is really to provide free books for kids. I've subsequently learned that as a kid, you just think like every kid gets this. I grew up in a fairly poor neighborhood. So apparently when my elementary school was on a list where they would come out, I remember it was once or twice a year, but I remember it was super exciting. There would just be tables and tables of books and you got to pick one book, to read. So that's something that was near and dear to me as a youth. And as I fear that the current generation of youngsters will be so sucked into Instagram and video games that reading may not be as prevalent as it was when I was a kid and had like four channels to watch on TV. I'm going to be making my donation to Reading is Fundamental.
Oh, that's such a good story. I rolled a tear.
Yeah, well, it's easy for you.
Yeah, I know, I cry about everything. So, in that light, let's talk about who I want to give money to. When we first started this episode, I was not 100% sure of where I wanted to donate money. And actually, when Livia started talking about where he's going to donate money, I was not sure. And then just like a light bulb went on, and I was like, this is the place I want to give money to. Livia, have you ever heard of the Electronic Frontier Foundation?
Yes, but I have no idea what they do, but the name is familiar.
Electronic Frontier Foundation is basically very big on, I'm going to read from their website. It's the leading nonprofit defending digital privacy, free speech, and innovation. So net neutrality being repealed by the FCC was a big story, that vote that happened recently. And I am a huge believer in net neutrality. And these folks do a great job of not just reporting on, digital privacy and other types of, you know, advocacy things, but also like helping with legal action and things like that. So they're very involved in advocating for the rights of people on the internet. And so I feel like there's a world where without net neutrality, things like our podcast maybe would have had more hurdles to jump through and things like that. So that is where I'm going to donate money.
A fine cause. Fine cause, Rob.
I don't know if you know this about me, but I was pretty big media activist back in the day, like in the late 2000s, like a decade ago.
I knew you were an activist. Yeah. I know you were a media activist.
Yeah, I went to conferences about media equality and stuff like that, and net neutrality was one of the big things. I was keyed in, man. I was hanging out with like Bill Moyer and stuff like that.
The people who use the internet.
Yeah, nerds. No. So it was a big cause that I kind of you know, step back on, because things were actually kind of going good for net neutrality during the Obama era. So I didn't really have to think about it too much. But now it's like, oh, God.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting to see what plays out and what the internet looks like 4 or 5 years from now. I mean, when you think about how much the internet has changed, do you remember when you first got on the internet?
Yeah, it was the dial-ups.
Yep. Yeah. So for me, it was a Windows 95 machine. So I have to assume it was probably like 1996.
Yep.
It was dial up and, you know, it just, the internet was nowhere near what it is today. And now it's the whole of human knowledge, right? Like anything you want to find out more about or learn about, or, you know, even if it's just information that you're looking for, not necessarily to learn, but a time frame, it wasn't always like that. So it's going to be interesting to see, how much more the internet brings us in the upcoming years. Big fan. I like the internet. It's good stuff.
Yeah. That's where they keep all the porn.
That is where they keep all the porn. I don't know, man. I think that Family Video, I haven't stepped foot in like 15 years, but I think that they still hold on to some of the porn.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. I love it.
It's like old VHS tapes.
Yeah. There was a story, and I don't know if it was true or not, about a guy who, I didn't click on the article, so I just read the headline. But a guy who downloaded like petabytes worth of porn because he didn't want to have to pay for his fast internet once net neutrality was repealed. Did you ever?
No.
But he got arrested. He got caught illegally downloading things. So kind of shot himself in the foot there.
Is there still illegal downloading? I mean, I know for a while there were all the stories like if you downloaded like, you know, whatever, like a Jay-Z album or something, like the feds showed up at your door and hit you with like a $20,000 fine. But I thought that was all done, that they started going after the providers.
Well, I don't see as many stories about like the individual like lawsuit kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I would hazard a guess that it just is not profitable enough, that the law, I would imagine the law has just kind of fallen in favor of the downloaders to the extent where like the people who are suing just decided it wasn't worth it. That's my guess.
Yeah. But it's a weird, it's like saying, you know, from a legal standpoint, like we're going to go after the guy who buys the joint instead of the guy who sells all the pot.
Right. Right. So, yeah. Well, yeah.
It's just a weird thing. I don't know. Anyway, so what you're saying is that guy's not available in case we have to borrow any of his porn.
Yeah, he's like, no. Yeah, all right, yeah, and I'm sure his hard drive is confiscated.
Petabytes. I don't even know. Yeah. So I'm guessing a petabyte is probably 1,000 terabytes, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
1,024. Well, I mean, that's I don't even know what to say about that. That's a lot of goddamn porn. I don't know.
Yeah. Cause like that's what's 1,000,000? Is that 1,000,000?
1,000,000, I believe, is 1,000,000, yes.
So 1,000,000 gigabytes?
Jesus. All right. Well,
that's
not sure how we got here, but
that's a lot of clicking fast forward.
So really what Rob's saying is that his donation is going to help that brother out.
His legal defense fund?
Yes, yeah. So, Rob, no, is that only donating to the EFF, right? The Electronic
Frontier Foundation.
Yep. Yeah. But it's specifically for that guy. Like there's going to be his note case on there that says, yeah, it's just
help out my brother.
Yeah. So that'll also be available, up on the Concord Free Press website for you to see our donations, shortly. Now, the other thing, you know, we talked a little bit about this. I don't know that we have to set away. I guess here's what I propose, Rob. And then, you know, we can edit this out or whatever. If you're interested, get a hold of one of us. If you know us on a more personal level, like if you have an avenue to get a hold of one of us, just get a hold of us and say, hey, you know what? I want this. Make a compelling argument. I guess we'll probably announce maybe where our books are going next episode. Do you want to do that?
Yeah. I had two thoughts about this. One thought was very much like you, where it was like, hey, whoever's interested, just let us know. And we'll decide based on that. The other thought was like, I also imagine that this would be a good book where like when someone who's excited about a certain type of fiction is asking us for recommendations, like we get people asking us about books all the time. That would be the book I would say, hey, I think you'd really enjoy this. Also, there's like this giving aspect to it. So like either I want to just do it on like kind of the first come first served, like let us know if you want it kind of basis, or like hold on to it till it's going to be like a really good thing to pass along to someone. So I'm not sure.
Right. So hit us up.
Yeah.
we'll make a compelling argument for why we should pass this book along to you, and then we'll do our best. Ask Rob for a recommendation for a book. Sounds like a good way to go.
Yeah, hey,
Rob,
right to my heart. Anything?
Yeah, he's like, I'll tell you what I recommend. It's tough because you're really asking someone to give something. Again, it's non-specific. There is no specific monetary number attached to it. Maybe it's outside of somebody's comfort level to do that. So we definitely want to follow the tradition. Follow the feel of the book and do it the right way. So I will be signing my copy probably as soon as we're done here, and we'll get these books moving.
Yeah, and you know what? I guess we should thank really quick Stona Fitch, who is the editor in chief, Concord Free Press, who when I reached out replied almost immediately saying, "Hey, we're going to send you some books." And so first of all, thanks for like the promptness with which you responded. That was fantastic. Second of all, I found out that we were the first people to receive books after the contributors,
which is really cool too. I wasn't going to mention that, but
I love that kind of shit. So, you knew I was going to mention it. So big thanks to him for making that possible. And we're going to honor the spirit of Concord Free Press as quickly as we can.
I think that's going to wrap it up. The only thing I want to talk about is what we're doing next week, which, Rob, I'm really excited about. And I don't know if you understood that. Like, if you thought that was going to be an exciting thing for me.
I did not think it was going to be an exciting thing for you.
This has been available for a little while now, but we are going to review Mark Frost's Twin Peaks, The Final Dossier.
Yeah.
That ties in a little bit if you have never listened or were unawares. Rob and I do host another podcast called The View. And we spent the first 25 episodes, 30 episodes of that, whatever it was, reviewing Twin Peaks in its entirety. I don't know if reviewing is the right word. We discussed all of the episodes of Twin Peaks. So this is a promise from Mark Frost to clear up some questions that people had. So very excited to, I already started it. I'm not very far into it, but I'm digging it. I might be digging this a little more than I was digging Twin Peaks, the TV show itself.
The other way this ties into things, is if you are a listener of Booked, you'll know that Livius gave this as a gift to Jesse during our gift exchange for the Christmas episode, correct?
Correct, although it was not my intention to actually review it when I picked that out. I think we talked about it a little bit on the holiday episode. But yeah, I think it's great. I think it ties into what we're doing the other one. And questions, well, I've already gotten some answers. Did you start it, Rob?
I read like 5%. Okay. There's like some, yeah. So the format already is really interesting to me. But I guess it bears mentioning, too, that we're going to have a guest host.
We are a guest reviewer.
Yeah.
Yes. Jesse Lawrence will be guest hosting with us yet again. That's 3 times in 3 months, I think.
Yeah, that man, he might as well. He could step in if one of us had to bow out and just take over.
Yes, he probably could.
Yeah.
But yeah, Jesse will be joining us. It'll be fun. If you are a Twin Peaks fan, I think you're going to want to hear this one. I imagine that there's going to be spoiler talk. So real quickly, patreon.com/booked. If you are a contributor at the level of at least $1 per month, you get to hear spoiler talk. And if you've read the final dossier, or if you just want some insight, maybe spoiler insight into what happened to some of your favorite characters, I think I'm at 12 or 14%. And I know there are spoilery things we're going to want to talk about. So get on that now, and you can have that episode available to you, spoiler talk, roughly a week from now.
It's very exciting. And that means it'll be 2 books. In 2 episodes in 2018.
Yeah, I think that's how we started last year too. And then, I know the next episode is actually going to not be a book. So
I was trying to I was just trying to.
Yep. No, I hear you. Likely after that, we'll be having a night with Seth Harwood. Is probably the thing following that, although it's not been scheduled yet. We tried to do this late 2017. Seth had to overcome some obstacles before we could do this. He was doing some repairs or something at home that kept him from being able to do it. So we are going to probably do that before the end of January.
Yeah, and he's probably caught in a bomb cyclone right now.
I've heard this term a lot. What is a bomb cyclone?
Can I don't know. That's what they were calling that big blizzard that hit the East Coast like yesterday or whatever.
Gotcha. Except he lives in California, I think.
No, he lives on the East Coast now.
Oh, does he? Okay. He moved back. He did live on the West Coast, correct?
Yeah, he was living in San Francisco, but I think in a recent message to, I'm guessing just me, if you weren't aware of this, he said that he lives on the East Coast now.
I'm really bad with Facebook messages.
Yeah.
Just like, Livia's like any other kind
not
of
on top of the social medias.
No. If you want me to see a message, the best thing to do is message Rob and have him message me, because I read all of Rob's messages, but that's pretty much it.
That's pretty much where it ends, yeah.
Yeah, so it's Rob is my only important communicator, apparently, when it has anything to do with this podcast. So that's it. Episode one of the new year wrapped up. Great book, great cause. Next week, tie into The View. I mean, where we're really getting 2018 going with a bang, with a bomb cyclone.
With a bomb cyclone, my friend.
Until next time, I'm Livia Snedden.
And I'm Rob Olson. Keep reading.